Welcome to Season 5 of Kin Folklore, where we have gone through a portal and returned to the world of His Dark Materials for Season 2 of the BBC HBO series based on the novels written by Philip Pullman. Last week, we discussed how Lyra's good intentions backfired, the mystery surrounding Stanislaus Grumman, and the shared trauma of Lee Scoresby and Mrs. Coulter.
In this episode, we'll be covering all of the demon-changing and world-exploring action of Season 2, Episode 4, entitled The Tower of Angels. We'll recap the episode, talk a bit about our observations, and discuss some of the themes, and then we'll look through the Ember Spyglass for some background.
You didn't look for me. I summoned you. But kinfolk, we've risked life and limb and our perfect complexion through swamp and snow to bring you some episodes with adult content. And unlike Asriel, we're not so insistent on being the first one to do everything, busting our way through multiple worlds. We found a simpler way. Plus, our demons keep our hands to themselves. They don't think tiny Nagini. creeper. Real creeper.
Yeah, I have some thoughts on him. We'll get there. So should we get into the summary?
Yes, I can't wait. Boreal's fall from grace. Go, continue.
So this episode began with a voiceover explaining the origins of the Subtle Knife. 300 years ago, a guild of philosophers became curious about the bond between the smallest atoms. They created an instrument that could cut through the fabric that connects worlds. That instrument is called the Subtle Knife. The guild had a choice. They could use the knife for the benefit of all or the benefit of themselves. They chose the latter.
One ring to rule them all. It's the Subtle Knife. It's great.
Because of their choice, the specters emerged from the shadows, and then more specters came when Asriel opened the bridge between the worlds. And though the knife was born of hope, it was used for greed.
Enter Will Parry. Listen, I have a real problem with one thing that we haven't talked about, and then we'll move on with the rest of this and just talk about other things. But I really need the guy who wrote The Cursed Child and is writing this thing not to just jack the freaking Dementors. The Spectres look just like the Dementors. It bothers me.
It's true, but the Spectres, so this book was published before the Dementors made their
It's true.
Appearance.
It's fair. But I'm not talking about like in the books or the way the books are. I'm just talking about
the way they look. Yeah,
the way they look.
They do, you know? Look like Dementors. And they look like the Dementors from The Cursed Child.
Yes.
Not necessarily the Dementors from the Harry Potter movies.
Exactly.
But the ones from The Cursed Child. Like, I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
So after traveling further north, Lee and Hester find themselves in a swamp where they meet with an Asprey demon who leads them to a man named Japari / the one and only Stanislaus Grumman.
His mama named Joe Perry. I'm going to call him Joe Perry. Okay. I didn't like the way Grumman's demon came in dunking on Lee, talking about...
And Hester.
Yeah.
I thought you were more hare than tortoise.
Yeah, what the... Even Hester goes, hey, what's up with that? Yeah, I didn't like it. I didn't dig it.
So Grumman tells Lee that he actually summoned him there with his mother's ring. Not that Lee just decided one day he wanted to come look for him. And he wants Lee to help him find the new bearer of the subtle knife.
Return. This guy is such a clown.
Oh, Stanislaus.
Never trust a man who's like chopping it up with you and he's got a full-on man bun and he's had a time to do something about it. Never trust that guy.
So he wants to take the bearer of the subtle knife to Lord Asriel.
Wow.
Yeah. Which immediately Lee is like, well, I came here to help Lyra, and since you want to align with this garbage person who abandoned her, I'm out.
Lee's like, I don't like that guy, all right?
Yeah. And Grumman is like, what's your point? I mean, in fairness to Grumman, I was also like, okay, so you don't like him.
Yeah.
But, like, I mean, that's not nobody likes Azrael.
Yeah, he's like he's a failure as a man, a failure as a father. Like, come on.
He did basically say he's a failure as a father.
He did. He was exactly what his whole point was. This is why Culty fucks with him. You know what I mean? Like, she fucks with him. He was like, nah, I don't mess with that guy at all.
So when Lee challenges Grumman about allying with someone like Azrael, Grumman tells him the story of when he abandoned his family. He said that he tried to get back to Will and Elaine, but the door to his world was closed. Hmm. And so he had to stay in Lyra's world, where he became a scholar and a shaman instead.
Interesting. Now, because the door was actually right next to Jordan College. I'm not really feeling him on this one. It was like right there. Like, Boreal found it. He came up on a whole fortune and, like, you know, basically got knighted by the queen. This motherfucker has been to and from multiple times. Why did Joe Perry not find this?
I don't have an answer for that. What we can say is that in the books, Joe Perry ends up crossing accidentally. So it might have been that he was looking for the portal that was open for only a short time, and then the bearer closed that portal.
Yeah.
So I don't think he's aware of the other window.
Yeah, I'm playing. I'm just messing. I just I'm just out on all of these guys.
So I'm out on all the parents.
Yes.
All the parents. Listen, we still only have one good model of parenting in this whole show. Ma Costa.
Give it up. The one and
That's
only.
It. The rest of the parents in this show have real questionable behavior.
John Fa was like, I'm in. John Fa and Ma Costa, I like them. They're like, listen, we're going to get these kids. We're going home. Fuck all the rest of this drama. I'm not here for it.
So Grumman sort of says that because he can't get back to Will and Elaine, that now his responsibility is to leave a better world for Will. That's how he can be a good father, where he is able to think for himself and be free. Lee agrees to take him. Once he hears this, he agrees to take him to find the bearer of the knife, but he has a very specific request, which is that whoever that person is, that the Lyra must also be under the protection of the knife. Grumman is honest here. He says, like, I don't know who the bearer is. Mm-hmm. Ah, surprise, spoiler alert, it's your own son. And I don't know what kind of person that bearer is going to be, but
that's true.
Definitely doesn't know.
He bounced.
Exactly. Exactly. That he doesn't know for sure. But he's like, I will do what I can to help Lyra be under the protection of the knight. So they set sail in Lee's balloon, which, did I miss something? How did Lee get his balloon back?
I didn't understand this either. This seemed like a backup balloon that he had someplace else. Could it be?
Yeah.
It had to be. Because they
seized the other one. I wondered that too, because, like, they went out of their way not to get the balloon. And then all of a sudden he has a balloon.
Yeah. Yeah, and I just want to add, he goes, well, get up there, wait till you see this, as long as we get a good win. And, you know, Grumman is like, leave the win to me. And I'm watching this with my fiance. She goes, what is this guy, an airbender? How the fuck? I was like, she's not wrong. Like, right? Like, it's like, man. And he was sitting there looking like a Coachella DJ with his hoodie. Like, zipping back and, like, doing all this weird shit. I didn't know what was that dance, you know? So anyway, but he did get the win going. So
he did. Him. He did. Yeah. And they are on their way.
Good for him. Back in Chittagatse, Lyra, Pan, and Will look for and eventually find the door to the tower. And it's hidden on a street level with a door with an angel on it. Inside, they find what looks like a temple and they climb the stairs. They're followed by a teenage boy. At the top of the tower, they find Giacomo Paradisi, who has been injured. He's gagged, the whole thing. He tells them there's a boy hiding in the tower, and just then the boy attacks. During the fight, Will is cut by the knife and loses the tips of his ring finger and pinky, and the teenage boy flees, and Will passes out.
I just need to interrupt you for a moment.
Yeah.
It's a good thing Will took those boxes.
That was the first thing on my mind. I was like, yo, he literally he's a top-notch boxer in Chittagatse. He got his ass handed to him in our world, but he is out here jabbing, bobbing, weaving. If that guy didn't have a knife, man, shoot.
Yeah, he was prepared. It was, I like how they set that up.
Yeah.
That was good.
Yeah.
Good setup.
It was really, really, how did he like, he said, the guy, Paradisi, is out here sounding like Mick and Rocky. He's like, get in there, fight. And I was all like, yo, it's hilarious. And the guy starts throwing the jab with the, he has the chopped off fingers. And how he led with that jab. It was pretty impressive. I was impressed with Will. So when Will awakes, Paradisi tells him that he is the bearer of the subtle knife now. And he shows Will that he's also lost his fingers when he fought for the knife. So Paradisi shows that this is like the mark of the bearer, right? You lose these knives. Also, in the actual tower, there's like a kind of like a model or a figure or a statue with the same missing fingers that you see both Paradisi and Will have missing.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah, it was really cool. It was like there was actually like in the episode, you see like at one point there was like actually a hand. You see those fingers and it's like almost like a gold kind of like hand. So
I remember seeing the hand. I didn't make that observation. So good call.
Paradisi, right, tells Will and Lyra they don't have much time. He shows Will how to use the knife, but Will can't like focus enough because of the pain that he's with. You know, he kind of lost some fingers and he's bleeding out and it's kind of crazy. But Lyra does something here that I thought was really great. Lyra uses her experience to talk to him about when she first found the alethiometer. And she tells Will that she struggled with the alethiometer at first, but when she learned to accept the fear that she had around using it and inside of herself, she was able to clear her mind and focus. And Pan, in a moment that is just, we're going to talk about a little bit, offers comfort to Will as well and surprises Lyra, who did not expect for her demon to touch Will. Okay. Mm-hmm. So this is huge because in the books, it's a huge moment. Like huge, huge moment. And this is kind of like it happens and it kind of, you know, they kind of move quickly to the next thing. Because Will's like, did I do something wrong? And they explain, you know, probably for the first time here in the series that, you know, in that world, in Lyra's world, you're not supposed to touch somebody else's demon, right? We'll talk about that more.
Yeah, I think we should expand a little later because yeah. I have thoughts.
Yeah, we will talk about that more. But I just want to note here, one of the things that really is cool for me is just seeing that this is an expression of how Lyra's feeling inside about Will, mm-hmm. what she wants to do. She wants to reach out and touch and comfort Will. Even though she's doing it with her words, she wants to be close to Will in this moment. She can relate to what he's going through. And this is really starting to show you where this relationship is going, which is really mm-hmm. great. So Will tries again with this encouragement. This time he's able to see strings appear at the top of the knife. He pushes the knife between the strings and opens up a window to another world. Paradisi shows Will how to close the window and gives him the rules of being a bearer. He tells him like what he needs to think about holding this responsibility. Will and Lyra ask Paradisi to come with them since without the knife, the specters will surely get him. He declines and he drinks poison instead, dying moments before the specters attack. As they flee the tower, Will begins to see the outlines of the specters, which means he will shortly be vulnerable to their attacks. Meanwhile, the boy from the tower tries to hide, running through the street, looks into a window. We hear Angelica's voice, and he calls to Angelica, but he is taken by the specters. Back in the house, Lyra tells Will that the alethiometer told her that he was important and asks him what he wants to do next. He tells her he wants to steal it back, and they'll do it together, to which Lyra's pretty hyped about that. She has a smile on her face.
Listen, the alethiometer told her he was a good kind of murderer, so she's ready.
Listen, I also want to say that she lied. She lied again. This is Lyra at her best. She said, oh, no, don't worry. I'm backing up, and I'm just like, you know, I'm backing up and just bringing in towels. I can't see. And she sits down, and then Pan sneaks a little view of Will in the back, okay, which is basically her. She used her demon to get sneak peek of the dude she's checking for, okay? It's not cool.
Listen, the demons were all kinds of out of line in this episode because Boreal's was a mess.
Yeah, 100%.
So back in Will's Oxford, Mary Malone's colleague, Oliver, who we met previously, is showing Boreal the cave and, you know, giving him a little tour of the facility. He then introduces Boreal to Mary as a potential donor. When Boreal mentions that his interest in the cave has to do with defense spending, Mary declines the offer immediately and tells him to leave. She doesn't want her research to be used as a weapon. Later, she goes back to the cave and attempts to speak to it. And this time, she is able to focus. And to her surprise, the particles speak to her directly. Using words. The conversation is very illuminating. She asks the particles if they are shadows, dust, dark matter. And the voice replies yes to all. And saying that there's many uncountable billions of them.
Wow.
The voice identifies itself as an angel. Not human, but humans have always known us. And it states that what we are is spirit, from what we do is matter. Matter and spirit are one. And I was like, this is getting real deep.
Deep.
When Mary asks that if angels have intervened in human evolution, the voice responds yes. And when she asks why, it responds for vengeance.
I mean, whew, can we just say when you hear that voice come out, it was chilling. We talked about this.
It was very, I was hyped because we've been waiting for this moment.
Yeah.
It certainly, the voice gives clarity of what is happening, what dust is, what, mm-hmm. it's just so much. But when that voice said for vengeance, I was shook.
Because it's starting to unravel the core of what this is all about. Mm-hmm. And it's really starting to show that, you know, everything's pointing towards this kind of where the threads of the world have like divided, but that the world, even though divided, had parallel tracks that they're running towards based on what the magisterium would call, you know, the authority and all these other things. And I think it's interesting that it's Mary, because Mary, she's left this world of like the church and being a nun and all these other things so that she could pursue science and a PhD and research and get as far away from angels as she possibly could to now find herself and her research bring her right back face to face having a conversation with an angel. So I think mm-hmm. it's really profound.
So all fantasy stories to a certain extent rely on coincidence or on, you know, some kind of fate or destiny intervention. And I think this is a perfect example of when that really works. Only Mary can really understand and really have the open mind that is necessary to pursue this line of inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
Because only Mary of our characters has lived in both the world of reason and logic and scientific research and also of spirituality. I think her and Grumman are uniquely qualified to pursue this sort of line of questioning. And I think it really works here because imagine she has this conversation with Oliver after she kicks Boreal out.
Mm-hmm.
And she's basically like, did you listen to what he was saying? And like, listen, we have Lyra, like she can speak to this machine. And Oliver is kind of like, oh yeah, but whatever. This is like real money and real, mm-hmm. we could pursue our research. He doesn't necessarily understand the potential that Lyra is, not just because he hasn't met her, but also because I think he's not as open-minded. He's a scientist, right?
Mm-hmm.
So all this talk of angels and dust and different worlds, it's not true to him yet, even if he thinks he's open-minded to it. Yeah. So I think this is a really good use of like having the right character with the right experience in the moment. And the fact that Mary was a nun makes this moment so much more compelling to me.
I agree. And I think that Mary would be on the track of Mrs. Coulter and Asriel in their world, right? Because she's more accepted in this world because the church, as we said, and as you said in previous episodes, is not as heavy-handed and authoritarian in our world as it is in Lyra's world, right? So when you look at it, if she was in the same place as the Magisterium, she'd probably be a lot like a Mrs. Coulter-esque figure in the sense that she wouldn't be allowed to pursue this train of thought, these kind of inquiries. But
I mean, it would be heresy.
It'd be heresy. Heresy! Right? It'd be heresy. So the thing about it is, that she kind of senses, I think, a little bit that authoritarian vibe from Boreal when he starts talking about the defense funding and just in his persona about she understands that power corrupts. She's been part of an organization where she left because she didn't feel like she could explore these aspects of herself by being part of it. And that is profound for her to say, nope, I'm reject. Even if she doesn't know that's what she's rejecting, Boreal is a magisterian agent undercover in her world. And she still rejects the same kind of authoritarian instincts in that moment without even knowing that it's connected to what she's done before. So it's pretty cool. And speaking of Boreal, him and Mrs. Coulter meet up in a fine
date.
Yeah, a little date.
It was a nice restaurant.
Well, this is Mrs. Coulter showed up just to holler. Let's see what's going on. He tries to push this thing out of the friend zone, right? He's like really going for that. And I don't know that she's there yet. Boreal tells Coulter that, you know, I found a window. Unlike Azriel, who insisted he must be first at everything. You know, he's talking down on her boo, you know, like back in the day. And he wants to let her know, like, you know, I didn't need to do this grand thing. I just snuck through the window and I came up and now I know where Lyra is. So he tells her that she's with a boy and they're at Oxford, but a different Oxford, an Oxford in another world. Mrs. Coulter says, well, you know, take me to another world, Carlo. Which is really, really nice. She's well played, Mrs. Coulter. I like her in this thing. So, hands off, baby Nagini. Stop it. he tells her that Lyra and Will are trapped because he has possession of something that she wants. He never tells Mrs. Coulter what he has or that he's obviously been crossing between worlds for years. Coulter agrees to cross with him to the other world, as I mentioned. And since he promises that the reason she goes is that he promises that once he gets what he wants, that Lyra's free to go with her, right? So they cross into Chittagatsi, where Boreal tells Mrs. Coulter, move quickly. She's
okay. My girl is wearing heels. Yeah. Like, can we just have a moment here? I was like, okay, so you're doing all this extra stuff and crossing between worlds. Fine. You didn't stop and tell her, like, hey, like, when we get over there, it's dangerous. So maybe you want to put some, like, sneakers on?
It's wild.
Do you have a pair of flats?
You got something to help you move a little quicker? Because we're going to have to run for it because adults get eaten alive. Okay? Like, I just want you to know that this is a possible thing. And I just want you to run a little bit. But the thing about it is, Mrs. Coulter, yo, she is still, like, still in her guts. She looks over at the fucking specter, and she's just like, oh, what is that?
That's interesting.
That is interesting. I wonder what that is. What is that? Okay, I'm going to cross over now, but I do want to check that out at some point.
Like, I mean, listen, Lyra would have done the same thing. This is a... You see peaks of Azriel and... Mrs. Coulter come through and Lyra. And one of the things is that they're both kind of like, they're not afraid.
Yeah.
They don't move through the world with fear. Yeah. And that's what makes Lyra a great character and makes Mrs. Coulter a formidable.
Yeah.
A formidable adversary because she doesn't respond to fear in the same way you would expect her to. I would, if I saw one of those specters, I would have been
out of here. I'm like, oh, time to roll. Let's go. Let's go. But yeah, I think that, you know, in Lyra's world, there's something else we need to talk about. See, they've been off the board for a little while. Okay. Let's not forget the witches. Serafina is like, listen, I need to go holler at my girl Ruta. All right, let's go see what's going on. Ruta, Scotty, and her meet up, and Ruta's in the lands, and she sees that they've been destroyed and that hundreds of witches have been killed. And Ruta feels guilty, but Serafina tells her that they must follow Lyra to the other world and that Ruta should not feel guilty at all in this moment, that she understands. And she vows to help her. She wants to help her. Like, you know, let's go bring down the magisterium and cross through this portal. Will you come with me? Like, so we can go ahead and go after Lyra. And then Ruta says she will, but that she's going to go and bring back Azriel so that he can finish what he's been doing to bring down the Magisterium. The bridge that Azrael has created is heavily guarded by Magisterium airships, so they attack the airships. And when I say attack, they just, I mean, it was...
They explode them.
Yeah, it was...
it's just done.
Listen, there's only one other thing that I could see that was as powerful in an airship, and that was Toph metal bending, walking in there and wrecking people.
Yes, I mean, basically, this was very similar to Toph Beifong taking on the Fire Nation in the sky. It was awesome.
Yeah, if Toph could fucking fly, like if she could fly, she would have ran through all of those people like Serafina and then jumped out the thing like she did and just hovered. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that would have been the only difference. But other side of that, Serafina was on some Toph energy right now. She was fucking people up. So that's how it ends. They basically wreck those airships and they cross over through the portal. And that's where the witch's storyline is concluded.
Yeah. What a great scene.
Yeah. I loved it.
That was awesome.
I loved it.
So let's talk about some of the notable moments from this episode. Well, actually, before we do that, what did you think of the episode?
I liked it. I did. I really did. I really thought it was... It was one of the better, I think if not the best, it was one of the better episodes of this season.
I think it was in my opinion, this was the best episode of this season so far.
Yeah, that was where I was feeling like, you know, I think they had a lot of the things that we were waiting to see. I think, you know, ultimately, I encourage anyone who's watching this show and generally kind of feels like, if you're watching this show and you feel like, I don't know that I'm really into this story, or you're watching this show and you're saying to yourself, man, this is cool, but I wish they did more of this, I would encourage you to read the books. Like, that's what I'm going to say. Like, because I feel like, we talked about it offline, I do feel like they're speeding through some things that we'll talk about here that kind of like, that kind of concern me a little bit. I really think the part that bothered me the most was, you know, the scene the scene with Lyra and Will, where Pan touches Will. That is like a memorable moment in the book that you can't just move off of like quickly. It needs to be explored because there's so much there in the complexity of what Lyra's feeling. And I think, as you've said to me offline and we talked a little bit about, that some of that is because a lot of the story is told through Lyra's perspective. So you really get a feeling for what she's going through in that moment and what she wants to do to comfort Will. So I just think like things like that are just being, they're broad stroked, and it's hard to broad stroke something that's, to me, Pullman did a good job of laying out.
Yeah. So there are times when the audience gets kind of restless with the story and is annoyed by the fact that certain things aren't explained. And I usually respond with that, well, that's not explained yet in the book. But there are things that the show is shorthanding that are explained in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I get frustrated, because this story already has a lot of mystery in it. Like, the subtle knife is really where the story starts to clarify itself. The golden compass is really just introducing us to the world and mm-hmm. the landscape. And so it annoys me deeply that we're at this point and now a character is just telling us that it's not okay to touch other people's demons.
Mm, I agree.
I was very irritated with that. And then I liked this episode a lot. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was action packed. It had a ton of information in it. Mm-hmm. It did everything I needed it to do in terms of moving the story, and the acting continues to be really solid on the show. And that's like across the board, like the kids, the adults, everybody's really good. But this voiceover in the beginning really bothered me.
Yeah. I remember why? Like, why did it bother you so much?
I mean, we're clowning it for being Lord of the Rings, like, but like, that's what it's, I mean, it just felt like the Fellowship. Like, it really did. If Kate Blanchett had appeared on the screen, I would not have been entirely surprised.
Yeah.
It was such a departure from the way that the story has been told so far. So yes, we've had previous voiceovers, usually from Kaisa, who is telling us, like, you know, Kaisa told us about the prophecy. Like, we've had narrators before, who are filling us in on details that are kind of hard to get through in dialogue. Mm-hmm. But this voiceover told us something that then Paradisi and Grumman tell us again.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was just kind of like, I don't know. And then in addition to that, it left out details about Chittagazi that I felt like it could have included. So I just didn't like it. It felt like a departure from the way the story was told. It also just felt like a nod to The Lord of the Rings, honestly.
And I want to say, like, this is going to go super meta just for a second, because we tried not to go so meta. We try to really stay in the story and talk about the story. But, you know, I studied film for 4 years, 5 years of my life, and worked in that world. And one of the things that you talk about when you talk about voiceover and you talk about flashback is a lot of times in storytelling, it's used as a cop-out, right? In storytelling. Like you're basically pulling people out of the story or shorthanding things to get them information or exposition that you didn't really get done in the way that you scripted it. So it could be because they have short time and they're trying to get a lot into a short amount of time. I get it. Then who knows how many episodes they're going to get. But it does hurt because you just think, man, there's so much richness in how it unfolds without that, that you want to feel the journey. The journey is half of the battle in this story. It's like every time you get to a certain place and you think that you understand where it's going, something happens that flips it on its head that makes you say, oh my gosh, how did I not know that that was how that was going to go? And that's what you want to feel in this instance too. And I feel like some of that is lost with voiceovers. They're not doing it with flashbacks. There's no flashbacks. Thank goodness they didn't combo those. But that's something that I think we talked about that, you and me. We talked about how Game of Thrones had no flashbacks for so long, and then they went to them, and how jarring that felt for a while, you know? Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I just didn't, I wasn't a fan. Other people probably are. It was hard for me.
Yep.
I didn't appreciate the voiceover. It just felt a little bit too, and maybe it's because I watched the whole Lord of the Rings trilogy like last month, but it felt too familiar in that way.
But let's talk about something that's really important to me for us to get to. How you feeling about your boy Boreal now?
Oh my God.
What's up? All right.
I have many, many feelings about up to this point. Listeners, if you've been listening, you know that I've always had a little crush on Boreal.
Mm-hmm. It's documented. It's documented.
It's well known. It's well known. It's something that people know about me. All of that is gone. It's all gone. My thirst is dried up. I wanted him off screen as soon as possible. And this is why. Any man who's ever tried to approach me knows that the quick way to get an off ramp is to say something sexist. Boreal coming to Dr. Malone's office. Dr.
Emphasis.
Malone. She got a PhD.
Emphasis on the doctor, okay? Let's put an emphasis on that, all right? There's no, yes, please, go ahead.
After my girl has pulled an all-nighter and saying, I've always admired a woman with good work ethic. Sir. This is 2019, right? I think that's one of the stories. It's a year behind us, correct? Yeah,
yes.
2019 in Will's world, which is our world. You can take that big magisterium energy back to your world.
Okay? And you've been crossing mad long and news.
You're established, sir. You have gadgets and in a mansion and a nice car, but you don't realize we don't do that here anymore.
Yeah.
Then, okay, so I was already out on him. I was like, okay, you disrespecting Dr. Malone in her office, in her place of work. Okay. Then you trying to rub up on Mrs. Coulter, and she's not interested.
At all.
Sir, she is there because you sent her a message saying that you know where her child is. She done told you the last time she saw you to keep Lyra's name out of your mouth.
Exactly.
Now you're showing up, pouring wine, getting your little nasty snake to slither. No, sir. No matter how many times you call me Marissa, you're not getting in my pants tonight. It's not happening. Yes. Mrs. Coulter was not giving him any vibes like that. The golden monkey was about to wreck that little snake demon up. Okay?
She had to hold him back. She held him back. She was like, yo, what are you doing? Yeah, she had to hold him back.
So I'm out on Boreal. I don't think he can come back.
Can you just say that one more time? Because I knew this was coming when I saw that line. I was like, evil adjacent is done. This is the nail in the coffin.
Oh, whoa. So I just want to say for the record that when I initially said the evil adjacent comment, it was about Isred in The Witcher.
This is true.
Who is still fine.
This is... She said,
and is still just evil adjacent because he is still just an ally of Stregobor. Okay,
this Boreal, is not going to age well. I just want you to know, this is not going to age well right now. Okay,
I said still.
Okay,
I'm leaving the room for there to be a yet.
Okay,
so I just want to say for the record that last week I did agree to say, or maybe it was a week before, that Boreal is evil.
Yes, you did.
I was still kind of like, okay, he's evil, but he's fine, though. No. He's evil and he's sexist. Nah, I'm out. Done.
It's done. Finished. Finito. Here's the thing.
That's out. It's a wrap.
We're going to go. Okay, so he has an anti-feminist rant, right? He's totally the other, like, pro-patriarchy, so we know he's out on that lane. But then let's also go from the other perspective here of he also broke the guy code. Like, he's sitting up there talking down Asriel, hating, like, straight hater vibes. Like, you've built a whole life for yourself. And it kind of comes off like he did all that to impress Mrs. Coulter because he felt inferior to Asriel's swag. He really
was going hard on the Asriel's trash. Can we also just note for the record that everyone in this series hates Asriel?
Everyone.
Like, let's just go through the list of the people who are like, Asriel's garbage.
I'm on record of saying that in episode one. Uno.
You really are. So the headmaster at Jordan College tried to poison him. And I re-listened to our podcast right before we started. We were not even that mad.
No.
He tried to poison him.
No, not at all. We were like, we thought it was like, man, what a miss. What a miss.
Obviously, Mrs. Coulter thinks he's a failure as a man and a failure as a father.
Yep. Documented.
Bruman is like, yeah. He's trash, but he's not wrong.
We're going to use him. We're going to use him in his trash ways, okay?
Lee just flat out says, I don't like that guy.
Yeah.
Have Lee and Asriel ever been on screen together?
Not at all. He just knows that he abandoned Lyra, and he's friends with, and he knows that there was some weird things that happened that messed up with the bears. Like, remember, they were going on their route to find Asriel, and then everything that happened with the bears, with that whole thing. So he's out on that because he's cool with Yorick. So, you know,
Boreal doesn't like him.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure newly appointed Cardinal MacPhail hates him. Listen, this guy Ruta Scotti seems to be the only one who's not totally out on.
Well, you know, the D will change your mind about things. You know what I mean? Like, she's like. I mean, Mrs. Coulter had second thoughts at the portal. She was like, but Lyra's here, so I'm going to stay. But, you know, this is what happens. This is what happens.
Yeah, it's just not a good look for Asriel. Also, Boreal, I'm done with you. Do not call me. I'm blocking you on all of the socials.
Get out of, no DMs. No DMs. Out of the DMs. Out of here. Cool. I love it. And then so let's talk about a little bit about Lee and Grumman's conversation, right? Like, so what about They're talking about an upcoming war, two forces, those who want to repress and those who want us to be wiser. So this is setting the table again for this same conversation that we're having about the actually what we were just talking about with Mary Malone and kind of what she was dealing with and kind of like the pursuit of knowledge versus like this idea of like being overrun by an organization or by a religion or by a world order, right? Mm-hmm. So what were your takeaways on that?
Yeah, I thought, so this conversation with Grumman and Lee was quite illuminating. And it reminded me of the conversation between Azriel and Lyra from last year's season finale, where we're finally starting to see the outlines of this war being defined. So mm-hmm. previously, we knew we were anti-magisterium. It's not really clear what Azriel's up to, even till this point. And I still don't think I don't think all the characters in the show fully understand what Azriel's up to. Mm. But Grumman is really explaining there are two factions here. One that wants you to live in the dark and one that wants you to be free. And so what is freedom to him? Freedom to him is the ability to ask questions and pursue the answers and to think for yourself. And so to me, this was the best summation of what this story is really about.
Mm. Yeah, I think I like that because it was really clear. And it was a very good summation about where this story tracks and what everyone's after in it, like what the different sides are of this battle. Because they keep talking about this war. They keep talking about the prophecy. But this is I think Grumman's had enough time up there in the mountains, you know, with his man bun to figure out what's really going on here. So good on him breaking that down. And I also like that Lee is advocating for Lyra in these moments. He's like, mm-hmm. he's still true to his mission. He's like, okay, cool with your war, cool with like, you know, finding the bearer and helping your son. But listen, I need to make sure that in all of that, Lyra is protected because she's mm-hmm. the most important to me, which is really cool. And it's also Paradisi's point. He says to Will that, you know, Lyra, your friend with the demon, is wise.
Is she, though?
I mean, with the alethiometer, she's unstoppable.
That's true. But is she wise?
I think she's gaining wisdom. To be completely honest, she is. I think she's not there yet, but I think he's speaking in the affirmative in the future, because I do think that she is able to see things. She is perceptive in a way that Will is not always. Like, Will is more perceptive in his world, but he was having a hard time in the middle to the end of this episode in how to embrace what he was dealing with. And she was able to use her life experience and lived experience to help him adjust in real time to what was going on, even down to when he stopped at the end to look up at the specters in the tower
she
kept him moving and kept him. So I think she's gaining wisdom, you know?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I have a hard time letting go of some of the major mistakes that Lyra has made, but I think that's fair. I think Lyra's gaining both wisdom and knowledge and, wisdom and empathy is what I actually meant.
Yeah. Yeah.
She is able to see the large picture in a way that Will isn't yet. And that's understandable because Will got into this because like his family was essentially attacked by Boreal's minions. And he really just wants to understand the mystery of his missing father. Lyra started out on this journey because she was trying to find Roger, but she now understands that there's more to this than Roger. And so I think if they can meet halfway with obviously his mission to find his father is part of her larger picture, what is dusk question.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I'm with you on that. I will say, as I've just given her all these kudos and her wisdom, I will take one cookie back. I'll just take one cookie back from her and from Will for one thing, the boy in the tower. Here's the thing. The boy in the tower is shook because he don't have the knife, and that was the only thing he thought that would keep him safe because he's seen his whole world get shattered, his parents killed. He's hit the age where he knows that the specters are going to come for him. And he thinks there's no other options for him. But there's two people in that fucking tower that know that there's another option for him. Actually, three, right? There's the bearer before he stops, the new bearer, Will, and Lyra. So when he runs up out of there, before he runs up out of there, why doesn't anyone say, you know what, bro, let's get you through this portal? And even furthermore, why don't they get Angelica and those folks through the portal so that they can be in Will's world and get away from the specters? Like, what would be the harm in that? I was thinking that the whole time, like thinking like, yo, y'all got the knife. Get this kid out of here before the specters eat him.
Yeah. I mean, there's this line from the book that is really beautiful. And I won't spoil it because it could be in one of the next episodes. But it's basically about how when you see someone struggling, you should help them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you see someone in this kid in the tower who, you know, is likely Angelica's brother,
mm-hmm.
who previously was mentioned when they first met Our Lady Mormont. but he's scared, and he's scared for good reason, because as soon as he leaves, he gets taken.
Yep.
And this is a thing that's looming over all these children. So obviously these kids are desperate, and desperate people do desperate things. And I just wish that they had the opportunity to explain to him, you know, that we'll try to help you. But like in this moment, Lyra and Will are only thinking about
their mission,
the urgency of their mission.
Yeah. And I think like that's where I think when I say that about taking something back is I feel like there has been a lot of collateral damage to this prophecy and this mission. I mean, mm-hmm. there's been so many. We've lost like children in Lyra's world. Obviously there's Roger. Obviously there's little Billy Costa, you know, and it continues to add up the levels of like, hey, on the way to getting to where we're going. So I just think that it's a good lesson for all of us. Yes, we all have goals, we all have missions, we all have things that we're trying to accomplish, but it's real important not to forego some of the humanity that we have while in pursuit of them. So I don't know. I thought about that a little bit of like, why didn't they just get that kid through the portal? Sucks. But anyway, there's a lot that was introduced in this episode. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a moment, look through the amber spyglass, and talk about a little bit of what that is.
So let's just talk about the subtle knife some more. As I have said, the show gave us quite a bit of information about it, but they didn't give us everything.
It's beautiful, by the way. It's just gorgeous.
It looks exactly how I imagined it.
Yeah.
So they rendered it perfectly. Like it's really incredible.
Okay.
So the subtle knife has more than one name. It's also called Esrhaethra. Which is what Grooming calls it as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's a short dual-edged blade made out of two different metals. So one side is steel, and it's like the sharpest steel ever forged.
Mm-hmm.
It can cut through any substance easily. And we saw it when it clipped off the wings off the angel statue. The other edge is from a material that we're not quite sure what it is, but it's the same metal that is used to perform intercisions, mm-hmm. which is separating a person from their demon. So Lyra noted that it was the same, it looked like the metal that was going to cut her and Pan mm-hmm. in Bolvanger. It's slightly shade colored,
mm-hmm.
so we're not quite sure what it's made of yet, but it is able to cut through even the smallest particles, if it's wielded with the right intention.
Mm-hmm.
This side of the blade is like so sharp and so precise that it can cut through the fabric of the universe, but also like not everyone can see that fabric. Only the bearer can see it and feel the fabric between the multiverse, mm-hmm. between different worlds. So he's able to open portals to alternate universes. And as the show tells us, you know, this knife was forged 300 years ago by the Torii degli Angeli, which is a guild. We're going to talk a little bit more about that, of philosophers from Chittagong. So we know that this knife was used to amass wealth and trinkets for the guild. And we also know that whoever has the knife and is able to wield it to cut portals is called a bearer. We only know of Paradisi. I'm assuming he's not 300 years old. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure there were other bearers, but he's the only one that gets introduced. It's not really clear how you become a bearer other than that Paradisi had to fight for the knife, which is how he also lost his finger. So I'm assuming that usually when the knife exchanges hands, it's because there was some kind of bloodshed involved.
Yeah.
And so I just want to note that the name Esrahetha literally means God Destroyer. Wow. So I think we're getting a little bit into what this knife is actually capable of doing, and where the story is going. So I'll leave it there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely. Stay tuned, because that's an important fact. So let's talk about the guild. The Guild of Torre Degelli Angeli included philosophers and researchers in Chittagatsi who created the knife upon pondering the same questions that the scholars in Lyra's Jordan were pondering about dark matter, and the researchers in Will's world are attempting to answer. According to Grumman in the books, the guild created the subtle knife and then used it to pillage other worlds and accidentally let the specters in by cutting through the fabric of the universe. The specters were not originally of the world of Chittagatsi and have been tormenting the adults of Chittagatsi for years. Will ponders in the book if the specters actually came from his world, wondering if specters tormented the mentally ill as well. The guild was secretive and built its headquarters, the Tower of Angels, in Chittagatsi, and did their best to protect the knife. Not much beyond this is known about the guild. They have appeared to have disbanded or died off by the end of the novel.
So we talked a little bit about the subtle knife itself and also the guild that created it. And it's worth talking about the rules for the bearer of the subtle knife. So Paradisi gives Will these rules, and mm-hmm. these rules are really important to how the bearer of the subtle knife handles it, because it's obviously a very powerful tool. So the first rule was never open a portal without closing it, which, you know, clearly is one that hasn't always been followed, because Boreal has been crossing at Will. Also, never let anyone else use the knife, which just to me sounds like should be rule number one. Yeah, but, you know,
exactly.
Never use it for a base purpose, which I wonder, I had the question about this one. Was this always a rule, or was this one that they added because the knife had been abused? And also the final rule was keep it a secret. The knife has to be a secret because yeah. it's a powerful tool. It can be used as a weapon and you don't want to be flashing it around.
Well, I feel like number four failed too. It's the worst kept secret in three different worlds. Like, maybe our world doesn't know anything about it, but Boreal and like freaking Fra Pavel, they're like chopping it up about the knife and the boy in the tower and the angels and this and that and that. So I don't know, man. They got to do better with these rules.
Whoever... Yeah, I would love to know a lot more about Chittagatsi, and just because like I want to understand how it is that the knowledge of this knife got out.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, this is obviously an extremely powerful tool, and some people have been able to find this portal that was opened at some point and never closed again, that Boreal uses. But I would, you know, I think there's more to explore here. This sounds like a great origin story.
Yeah, it's really cool. And these are rules that we want to keep our eye on, because I think they really do play out in the story. So.
So we should talk about our theme for this week,
mm-hmm.
Which was the cost of knowledge and the pursuit of knowledge. So in the story, the guild, Mary Malone, Grumman, Lyra, Will, everybody,
yep.
all have one thing in common, which is that they're seeking knowledge and the truth.
Heresy!
in that quest for knowledge and the truth has led to dire consequences. It's the pursuit of knowledge from other worlds that led the guild to create the knife in the first place, and obviously led to the downfall of Chitagazi. Now the city is essentially abandoned. In the process, they also let the specters in. So this is now a city where the adults hide in the shadows, if at all, and children are left to their own devices. Grumman, too, left his family to seek the unknown and answer deeper questions about the universe, not knowing that he wouldn't be able to return to them, that the portal that he used would never be open again. Will and Lyra are seeking not just the knife, but also to get back the alethiometer, and the alethiometer is the object that has access to knowledge, and it leads to Will losing two fingers and a very serious injury. Our characters are all attempting to learn the mysteries of the universe and to answer big questions, but it always comes at a cost. And this is not an accident. This is one of the main themes of Pullman's story. As Grumman says to Lee, freedom is knowledge. Being able to ask these questions is freedom. And to think for yourself is freedom. And we've seen the Magisterium try to suppress the pursuit of knowledge, even in their attempts to destroy most of the world's alethiometers, making Lyra as one of the few remaining. Recall the conversation that Lyra and Azrael had about dust in the finale of season one. Dust is sin, created by the original sin. In Christian theology, the original sin occurred when Adam and Eve ate the fruits of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. This act led to the fall of man. And as they continue their quest for knowledge and truth, what other consequences may our characters face? Does knowledge lead to freedom, or does it lead to some kind of suffering?
Yeah, I think it, and obviously it can be both, right? It can be like you can be free and also suffer on your way to that freedom. And man, I really think Pullman is really taking... he's really going at the idea that we should give up our pursuit of, like, he's not in support of this. I'm saying he's going at people who try to suppress knowledge and suppress the pursuit of information, and that, and really this idea of magical thinking and oppressive organizations. He is standing in this work pretty much firmly against it in what I've seen so far and what I've seen in the show. So it's really, really interesting work.
We're meant to ask questions. And I think what he's getting at here is that the urge to subdue that question asking and then trying to answer those questions is to wield power.
Yeah.
So I think it's this episode really got into that theme, and I appreciate it because it's one of the first times I've really seen the work cross over so well, like the larger themes. I always wondered if this show would be able to adapt to the religious themes, and this episode proved to me that they're capable of it. Let's just make sure it's consistent and they keep at it.
I mean, he's questioning institutions as a whole, even. Like, when you look at what he's doing, even in the piece around science, drawing that comparison between the church and science, and how, like, you know, Mary really has to take that stance of, like, look what, no, defense, like, spending, I'm not doing that. Because how many times has, like, a scientific invention got into the hands of somebody who wanted to utilize its power for evil or something that harmed tons of people? So it's like he's even poking at those organizations, which is pretty profound. You know what I mean? When you think about it, like in the work. So I like it. I like where we're going. I'm enjoying this. Are you enjoying it so far?
Yeah, I have to say I had high expectations for this season because of the three books, The Subtle Knife is my favorite. And I'm liking it so far. I do think that, you know, I've heard some frustration from some folks about the previous episodes, but this one really, it was a good reminder that when this show can stays at the themes and it stays true to the source material in terms of like the theme and what the goals are here, it does It does really well.
Agreed. I totally agree. Well, all right. We are at the end of episode 4 of season 5 of Kin Folklore and season 2 of His Dark Materials. And you know what? We really want to stay in contact with you. So yeah, hit us up on our social media, please. You know, get at us at Twitter, at Kin Folklore Pod, Instagram. Go ahead and you know, go and check out over there. Facebook is one of the places where we, you know, we post all the episodes. You can go to our website, kinfolklore.com. And man, I'm about to jump on this this new app everybody's talking about, but I ain't gonna talk about it. I ain't gonna shout them out. They ain't give us. But there's an app where there's a lot of tea being spilled, and I'm gonna be over there. I may announce something for you guys to do. Hey, Andrea, are we gonna do this hate watch? What's happening?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it. We're gonna do a hate watch. Hate watch.
So we're gonna do the Golden Compass. Is that what we want to do?
Let's do the Golden Compass. We're gonna do the Golden Compass, and we will have an announcement on that soon. So. Yeah, hope you guys are enjoying, and we will see you next week.
All right, bye everyone.